Hi, everybody. Cora here. Welcome back to Rev On Air, the Rev On Air podcast, a place for sustainable storytelling with founders, activists, creatives, and phenomenal individuals who are paving the way for a more conscious future for us all. As we continue our Earth Month conversations, I am so pleased to bring on a woman today who I have followed for many years to help educate myself about the role of diversity within the climate and social justice movement. Leah Thomas, aka Green Girl Leah, and author of the incredible book, The Intersectional Environmentalist. Leah and I discuss the beauty of nature to connect us and how this is a moment for both action and self-care. I can't wait to tell you a bit more, but first I want to say a quick thank you to today's sponsor, Grassroots Co-op. Off the back of our collaboration with Zach Bush and Farmers Footprint, we've been speaking a lot about regenerative agriculture and healthy, nourishing food systems. Grassroots Co-op fits right into this theme with their incredibly thoughtful approach to farming. Grassroots is a co-op of farmers in rural America practicing regenerative farming that's better for the animals, the soil, the environment, and everyone's health. One of the ranchers in the Grassroots Co-op describes her greatest title and role as land steward. She's talking about her work to help heal the ecosystem on the ranch, to foster healthy grasslands and soil that's alive with roots and microbes, continually drawing carbon out of the atmosphere. Like all Grassroots partners, she manages the ranch based on principles of regenerative farming. They have also joined Land to Market, an esteemed organization that verifies raw material production for its positive ecological impacts that is bridging the gap between regeneratively farmed land and consumers. If you're interested in learning more and sourcing humane and climate-positive meats, head to Grassroots Co-op to discover their incredible efforts and products. That's GRASSROOTSCOOP.com. So now a little bit more about our guest today, the wonderful Leah Thomas. Leah is a celebrated environmentalist based in Los Angeles. She founded and launched the nonprofit Intersectional Environmentalists, a platform and resource hub that aims to advocate for environmental justice, provide educational resources surrounding intersectional environmentalism, and promote inclusivity and accessibility within environmental education and movements. It has since become a leading resource for diverse and accessible climate education. Through Green Girl Productions, Leah has designed innovative programs like London's first Black Eco-Feminist Summit, Earth Sessions community-driven climate justice concerts, and a grassroots book tour of over 70 stops. Building on her work in the field, Leah penned The Intersectional Environmentalist, How to Dismantle Systems of Oppression to Protect People and Planet. The book serves as an introduction to the intersection between environmentalism, racism, and privilege, and as an acknowledgement of the fundamental truth that we cannot save the planet without protecting all of its people. Today, her and I will discuss how we can come together and support one another in the climate movement, how to avoid burnout and eco-anxiety, and the importance of pressuring our leaders to create meaningful change in an election year. I hope you all feel as inspired by Leah's work, passion, and thoughtful approach to the climate movement as I did. So now, over to her. Leah, thank you so much. It's so exciting to get to do this with you. I've been a big fan of your work for a long time, so getting to chat through it all and hear from you personally is so great. And I feel like you've got a lot of insights that so many people in our audience are keen to learn more about and, you know, be more aware of. So first of all, just thank you for joining us. And I guess to start things off, you know, I always really like to start at the beginning. I find it so fascinating. Like, all the guests we have on the podcast have such different journeys into the worlds of sustainability and environmentalism and activism. And, you know, I guess just starting from there, you know, what was sort of your pathway to getting involved in this work, in this movement, and becoming such a strong voice in the environmental space?
I feel some days like it just kind of happened, but I know that that's not the reality of the situation. But I don't know. I was always really passionate about social justice. And I think that's because of my parents. They took me to protests when I was really little. encouraged my sister and I to like write petitions if we were unhappy about something in school. So I think that's something that I thought was just relatively normal, but I think a lot of people don't grow up with parents that are really encouraging them to like challenge the systems that be while also being very respectful. But if there's something that doesn't feel right, finding ways to engage and kind of just understanding that things are changeable. So I guess that's something that I've just had within me for most of my life. And then I studied environmental science, and it wasn't because I don't know. I really wasn't an environmental activist or anything like that. I didn't watch like Cowspiracy and all the documentaries. I just was like, I know that I like nature and I grew up in the Midwest and I like animals. So environmental science seems cool. And then it didn't really click until, I don't know, social justice movements were happening at the same time. So a lot of like racial justice organizing was happening when I was in college leading up to 2020. And then I started to see the intersections between those things and the people who are the most impacted by environmental hazards. So I feel like that got me really interested in it, raising awareness about that. And then, secondly, and also more fun, I was seeing a lot of really diverse and beautiful stories, whether it was, women and ecofeminism and the environmental movement, Black and Brown folks, Indigenous stories, and just seeing the beauty of uncovering those stories and sharing them a little bit more. So I started on social media. I was also writing op-eds and things like that. And then just really wanted to see how I could just successfully raise awareness about the inequity, and then also the beautiful stories that include diversity and inclusion within the sustainability space.
Yeah, and I think it's so important to kind of revisit these conversations over and over again about the fact that, especially now what we're seeing is that the people sort of least responsible for the climate crisis are suffering the most from the effects of the climate crisis. And the injustice of that is sort of hard to wrap your head around when you look at it, especially like on a, I mean, you and I are both here in the States. That's, we've got our fair share of problems here, but when you look at it from a global perspective, it becomes even more sort of startling, I want to say, and really kind of can feel overwhelming. But I feel like, I would love to hear, just because I think it's really important to reiterate, how we sort of got here. Why is it the people that genuinely really have done the least to deserve this are sort of now suffering the impacts of it the most? And in your own work and your studies, how you've sort of seen the origins of this and how we've sort of perpetuated it as a society. I just think it's a really important conversation to have, and you're such a great person to have it with.
Absolutely. Some of it kind of goes back to, I guess, structural inequality in the United States. So typically, like lower income communities face the brunt of environmental hazards, and then also Indigenous and communities of color within the United States. And then sometimes there's a lot of overlap. So lower income and communities of color are more likely to face environmental hazards. But I say that because I think a lot of it has to do with power. Because even if we're talking about like white rural communities that used to be like coal mining communities that maybe don't have a lot of like resources and things like that, are also struggling with environmental injustice. And then also, if we look at, say, like an urban environment in Los Angeles or wherever it might be, that's just like surrounded by highways and toxic waste sites and facilities, and was a historically, I guess, in the past, like formerly segregated city. Gentrification is changing where people are living a little bit. But historically, because of housing discrimination, we see certain communities in certain areas to this day. And it's not because housing discrimination has like gone away completely. It's also just because there's a lot of like historic roots. So even in Los Angeles, you might be in like Little Ethiopia or Koreatown or like a historically African American community. People want to stay amongst their culture. But when housing discrimination was legal and segregation, we saw more landfills and toxic waste sites and those sorts of things being built in those, Black and Brown communities. So that's why we still see that inequity today. And it makes me really sad because I want to believe that humans are better than this sometimes. But a lot of times when people don't assume a community has power, they're more willing to place toxic waste sites in that community or hazards. And yeah, it's really sad and it happens.
100%. And like you said, you know, I think historically race has come into it so much. I think now we're looking at, you know, poverty versus not like impoverished areas, mm-hmm. you know, there's all sorts of things. And it is true. It's sort of like, it does feel like the people in power, they prey on those who they feel are, you know, I talk about this all the time. Like, you know, if you're talking to an oil executive who's trying to like convince you fracking, for instance, is safe. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, so you'd put it in your backyard then, right? And it's like, well, no, you know, I wouldn't put it in my own backyard, but it is safe enough to go in others' backyards. And I think we're starting to, luckily with like social media and a lot of things, this is starting to become more like, you know, people are more aware of it. But how do you feel like in your own experiences, you've found, oh, sorry, if I froze for a second, everybody.
I can see now. Okay.
Cool. But you know, how have you found ways to fight the power? I mean, I think that's kind of where we're all at right now. I think everybody, you know, we're recording this early January. Obviously the statistics have just come out that 2023 was the hottest year on record. I saw on the New York Times this morning that something like a quarter of humanity lived in drought for the last 2 years. You know, it's, I think we're getting to a point where people are starting to really wake up to this, but in terms of finding effective ways to kind of change the status quo, have you experienced anything that you have felt was more effective than others, or mm-hmm. areas where you were like, this felt right, and this seemed to have more movement maybe than other things?
I would say one, making a lot of noise, even if it's on social media. Yeah, that's something, I don't know, like even just talking about intersectional environmentalism and environmental justice in mass in 2020, I remember then like watching a video where the White House started talking about intersectionality in the environmental movement. So they pick up on the language that we're using and just making a lot of noise and mobilizing. And honestly, that was a pretty quick change. There was a call for both racial justice and environmental justice that was kind of sparked by the quote unquote racial awakening of 2020. And then within a couple of years, we see the first Office of Environmental Justice, an Environmental Justice Council, an environmental justice advocate leading the EPA, and like billions of dollars for environmental justice for the first time in history. So I would say making a lot of noise does work. And I know sometimes it is really, really slow, but if you can garner enough attention and momentum and kind of put pressure on political leaders, things have to change. And the same thing with corporations. And I know sometimes people might be cynical and say, well, this corporation doesn't really want to make clothes ethically, or they don't really want to do things this way. But they understand that Gen Z is more likely to purchase from a brand that is ethical and sustainable and mission-based and aligned. So if you make enough noise, and then if you also shift like your like who you're buying from, who you're not buying from, that definitely will change things for sure.
And it's funny, you know, that actually leads me into a question that I did have. I was listening to your conversation on the Goop podcast when I was sort of preparing for this. And you said, you know, you said this quote that I absolutely loved. And it was that I know from firsthand experience that a lot of the consumer options that are made ethically can be more expensive, and that that has been a barrier to entry for sustainable living in a lot of ways due to income. But, you know, but that there are also like alternatives, you know, and I have suffered from this personally, you know, so much. Like it always seems like the more like ethical option is 9 times out of 10, the more expensive option, whether that is buying organic food or, you know, getting heat pumps put in, like all of these things come with a cost that's very real. So how have you sort of thought of this as, you know, not buying your way into sustainability, and how you can engage with people in a way that's like, we can make shifts that don't necessarily cost money?
I would say for people who can, they definitely should. It's just like, I feel like if you are able to like donate a percentage of your income and it's not going to like impact you, I think people should support community-based organizations. So I think it's definitely on a scale. And I think there are a lot of incredible options and technology and brands that if people know in their heart of hearts that it won't really like break the bank if they change those lifestyle choices, that they definitely should. So that was a really fun conversation on the Goop podcast, because there are a lot of people who are regularly buying from Goop that very much so should get those things. But then again, it's also on a spectrum. So I want to make sure people know that like you're also being sustainable if you're thrifting, if you're reusing things, all those sorts of things. So really just finding what works for specific people. And I always joke around, I used to work at Patagonia headquarters, and I couldn't even really afford the clothes. We just had a 70% discount. So that's how I was able to buy so many Patagonia puffer jackets.
We've all been there
But
working at places where we can't actually afford to shop ourselves. You're like, oh.
So I totally get it. It's really inaccessible. And I want people to do what they can. And I go thrift shopping all the time, and I try to make changes around the house, but I don't want people to think that I'm making excuses and not encouraging people to do what they can. But I think just knowing that, life isn't really fair and it's all on a spectrum. So I want to encourage people to do what they can.
Well, exactly. And like I said, I think it's a lot more frustrating when you encounter someone who has the means to be living sustainably and is choosing to do the exact opposite. Whereas, there are a lot of people who literally would love to be able to afford to make those sort of choices. So if you are in a privileged enough position to be able to do that, like it really feels imperative that people start, looking at their own lifestyles and assessing like where they can make change. And I think, if we're talking about personal actions too, I feel like something that is big that I know you've sort of spoken about, we're talking about a lot here at Rev, is sort of the food movement, everything from, regenerative agriculture all the way to, making growing your own food, making food more accessible. And it feels like it's a nice conversation to have because there is sort of this really amazing movement, I think, that comes from food. And for instance, you also mentioned on that podcast that the Compton Community Gardens had been saved due to like, sort of a community outreach and stuff. We actually donated to that because I thought yeah, but I just felt like if Rev was going to donate to something that really was a worthwhile cause, and it was incredible because genuinely, no one knew if that was going to work. But, for instance, I'd love if you kind of would tell the story of that or sort of any other conversations or events you've seen where it's like, actually, like this can work, like community organization demand for things can really make change.
Yeah, I think land ownership is often a really big burden that's not talked about a lot, especially in Black and Brown communities. And even just like historically with Indigenous communities being displaced from their land, or, Black communities not having equal access to like buying land. And I think that's a whole another conversation for another day. But a lot of farmers in this country, it's kind of land that they've, not everyone, obviously, but land that's been passed on for generations and generations. So when it comes to like getting organic food or like community-based, like local food in areas that suffer from like food apartheid or don't have a lot of access to organic produce, projects like the Compton Community Garden, I just completely adore. Like they're in the middle of Compton and they're trying their hardest to like grow organic produce and then also teach people to learn how to, cultivate their own gardens, et cetera. But then the issue of land ownership comes up because they're renting that space. And a lot of community gardens, they don't actually own the space, especially if you're talking about urban community gardens. So they were facing the land that they'd been at for a long time being bought out by somebody else. So it really sparked that conversation, like I was mentioning, about the importance of actually owning the land when you can. And it was really great to see a community of people, I think even Snoop Dogg or something helped out to protect that really important area. And I think even just the fundraiser wrote it. Yeah, it raised a lot of awareness about just, like food justice in general. And it was successful. A lot of people came together, and hopefully it sparks more conversations about the importance of actually like owning the land or giving land to Indigenous farmers and Black and Brown farmers. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it really is an interesting one because I feel like, I was just looking at this organization and it's going to drive me crazy because I can't remember the name now, but it was sort of talking again about also the fact that a lot of, Black and brown communities or low income communities don't have access to things like being able to get into nature very easily, mm-hmm. like hiking or skiing or, you know, all the things that so many people take for granted that they're able to like get in their car and go and do, you know, relatively easily. And I guess, you know, I feel like as someone who's living in Los Angeles, as someone who loves nature, but it's very much, you know, also like women in an urban setting and who is doing a lot of work on this, you know, how important do you feel it is to be connecting people to nature? Like, do you think that's an intrinsic part of this puzzle? Because it does feel hard to tell people like save something that they have absolutely no connection to, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, nature has been so healing for me. And I was a park ranger intern twice when I was in college. So like in rural Kansas and then in Washington, D.C. So like completely different places. But I just love being outdoors. But I will say, I don't know, there's a lot of cultural things as well. Like just growing up, my family, we would like sit outside or, you know, go for a walk, but hiking was never something that we did growing up. We never went camping or anything like that. I think even just like the concept of going into the woods seems so wild. And it's funny sometimes when I was talking to my Patagonia friends, like my family would be like, why would you want to sleep outside? Like we work so hard to have a house. And like, I've talked to a lot of friends who might be like first generation students or come from a family of immigrants. And it's like another similar conversation of like, wait, we like left our country to come here. Like, why would we sleep on the ground? So like even the concept of like camping and wilderness exploration in the United States might be a little bit culturally different for other communities. And that doesn't mean that they wouldn't enjoy it, but just like, I don't know. That's why I love organizations like Outdoor Afro and Latino Outdoors, because they can really like put it within a cultural context. So I guess to answer your question, like one, I think it is really important to have outdoor exploration, but to really know your Yeah, and that's what I recording. Okay, so that's why I really love organizations like Latino Outdoors or Outdoor Afro that have a level of like cultural competency. So they might know like, okay, maybe not everyone grew up with the same experience of, you know, their parents passing camping down to them, but let's like introduce them in a way that feels really safe, like surrounded by people who look like them. So I think that's a really important component to like outdoor exploration. And then secondly, I think it's really important to just show people that even if you're living in an urban environment, that's still an ecosystem and you can cultivate an outdoor experience. So even just like sitting on your porch in the sun, knowing a little bit more about urban foraging and like what plants are growing right outside of your house, going for a walk if you can, all those sorts of things are also outdoor experiences. So I think it's one, important to get people access to nature, like wilderness when you can, but that it's also just important to cultivate those experiences wherever you're at, whether it's the suburbs, a rural environment, an urban environment, etc., and knowing that that's still a part of nature.
Yeah. And it's so funny. There is this guy that I've started following in London called Spicy Mustache, which I feel like he's fat. You should totally check him out. You would love him. His name's Alessandro. And he lives where I used to live in East London, in Hackney, which is an area that is pretty devoid of nature, if I'm honest. And he is literally showing that in a backyard, in a small flat in London, he has been able to grow almost all the food he needs for like him and his partner. And it's incredible seeing what he's done. And I feel like, you know, there are ways to get excited about the environmental movement, no matter where you live. And even like small spaces can be really rich spaces. And it's a nice thought to think that we can kind of meet people where they're at and that there are starting to be leaders. And I think this is where social media is so great, that kind of help people figure out their passions, you know, like And I feel like that's nice because what you do on your Instagram, I feel like is really sort of direct people to different places where like that might speak to you or that might speak to you because it's not ubiquitous. It's not going to work everything for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think sometimes I'm like, what am I posting about today? Like it might be like me literally pickling something for the first time, but it's like a slow introduction for like a new audience of people. Like, okay, if you're interested in growing your own food or just, you know, here's something that I'm trying, or I might even be talking about like music and musicians who are also really interested in the environment. And then there's a particular, you know, part of my audience that just really wants like the nitty gritty about environmental justice. I'm like, okay, I can give you that too. But I just want it to be as accessible as possible to really just meet people where they're at with whatever interest that they might have and showing them that that can easily be connected back to the environment.
And it's funny. I feel like, you know, I was listening to, oddly, another podcast, How I Built This with Guy Raz, which I always kind of love because, you know, they're talking entrepreneurs. And he had on RJ Scarinch, who just started Rivian, you know, that EV company. And it was a great conversation. But the most interesting thing he said to me, because I've been thinking about this so much, is he was like, he was talking about how he didn't understand how the environmental movement had become so politicized. Like, he was like, I genuinely don't understand why. You know, he's like, we never take stances like that at Rivian because genuinely, like, electric vehicles made with chips in the US, made with, you know, as best as they can. Of course, there's a whole problem with EVs, I know. But basically, he was sort of saying he doesn't understand where all of this division over the environment came from. And I'd be interested, given that you have such a wide community, if you get those sort of issues coming up, like, you know, just so much division over one area that you would think we would all sort of be connected on. I mean, of course, coming at it from different places, but it does seem like the environment should be the one thing that we all have in common. And yet it has become so polarized in so many ways.
You would think, and I really do think it's like the thing that unites us all. Like, we're humans on this planet, like so many ecosystems. I don't know. I think it is something that should unite all of us. And we're slowly seeing changes politically, even on like more traditionally conservative folks are starting to explore, you know, renewable energy, regenerative agriculture, all those sorts of things. But I think sometimes complication does come up when people do think of the environment as apolitical. And if that's something they've had their entire life, they're like, well, I just go hike. And hiking is like not controversial at all. And it's like, true. But then if you try to teach people about, I guess, the land that they're hiking on and how, you know, what indigenous territory it may have been, which to me, I feel like enhances my experience and like allows me to pay respects and just know the history of where I'm at. So to me, I see that no differently of like just wanting to know what my native plants are. I also want to know who the native people who cultivated that land for a long time. So I do find that to be really interesting. Like, people are okay knowing the native, like the native name of a plant or which plant might be invasive, but not understanding the people who were once there and their histories and culture. So yeah, I think honestly, learning that information enhances my environmental experience, and I wish more people saw it that way. But I do think it is really unfortunate how politicized environmentalism has become because, yeah, I'm biased, but I don't think it needs to be political to like breathe clean air and drink clean water and those sorts of things.
Well, no, and it was, you know, and it is interesting, like, you know, and I don't know if you found any ways, you know, especially we're going into an election year here in America. I just know it's going to be highly, highly contentious for so many people. But, you know, have there been any things that, you know, you've sort of posted about or worked on where you were actually surprised at how people like came together over it? Because I think a lot of people are sort of looking like for those sort of things, you know, it's like, what are the things that kind of connect us rather than like drive us apart or lead to more like, you know, ferocious commenting on Instagram to like no avail, which always, you know, I'm like, how do people have the time? But, you know, it really becomes something that you're like, it can go south so quickly, but I guess it's like in terms of the things that you found that have worked well or actually felt good and been received really well. I don't know if you have any sort of examples of that.
And I think this is like very distinctly American, but anything that actually is bringing jobs, because I think that environmentalism wouldn't be as political as it is if there was more like job creation in communities that have like a really serious loss of industry. So for example, I think there are a lot of people who would be okay with renewable energy if it meant giving jobs back to people who lost their jobs because of maybe like the loss of industry, whether it's the automobile industry, the coal industry, et cetera. And I think there are a lot of people who are just concerned about what the future looks like and if they have a place in the renewable movement, or even a lot of America's farmers, like, are they going to be left out? We're talking about regenerative organic agriculture. Well, give them resources and subsidies and make it really easy for them to make that transition, make their livelihoods better. I think a lot of people just like their livelihoods are not okay. And that could be what's motivating them to maybe be like anti-environmentalism or anti-whatever, because they think it's going to negatively impact them. So yeah, I think that's something that I've seen really unite people across party lines, like making people's lives better and also just showing them that. And then I think separately, I guess like my most popular video on Instagram that I was really surprised by, I was sent this like box of, it was like a fake grocery store, and it had like a little capsule of clean water that allegedly costs like $200 in the future. Or it had like these little snacks, and it showed how everything would be packaged differently if we like continued to have drought, and that clean water would be more expensive. And it was just this really cool artistic kind of like, this is what the future could look like. So I think art can play an incredible role. And it doesn't always have to be like a really sad documentary. It could be something really unique, like the little box that I got. I think that really helps kind of sway public opinion. And I was really surprised. I think it got like 40,000 likes or something, which is insane. And I was not expecting that. I was like, no one's going to like this. This is a little cheesy, but I think it was like the perfect embodiment of the issue.
Well, no, I was just thinking about this because, you know, there's that new documentary on Netflix called You Are What You Eat. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's funny. I find myself like, I'm less able to watch documentaries that are like all about climate change and how horrible it is. It's like, and I sort of justify it because I'm like, I know, I don't need to like see any but like in theory, you know, I should be watching all of the things, but like something like that, which is just actually really like, what is the food system we want? You know, do we want like, do we want health? Do we want like to eat beautiful food that nourishes us? It almost seems like those are simpler questions to kind of digest. And, you know, oh, and did you know that that food normally does come from like a beautiful farm that's practicing better thing, you know? So it is sort of finding things, I think, where people can relate and actually feel hopeful enough to engage, because it is sort of, and again, I guess it's a question I would love to ask you is like, we struggle with it all the time at Rev, you know, navigating a company at a time where there is so much climate catastrophe, humanitarian crises. I mean, and you try to find a voice that is able to connect and bring positivity and hope and action without ignoring the problems, but also without, you know, being on the wrong side of it for, you know, because you're never going to please everyone, but you do want to address these issues. And I would love to know how you sort of deal with that on your own platform, because it's difficult, and we are living in such a tense time and the problems just kind of keep mounting. So finding the way to sort of approach this in a positive way that's leading to hope and action, like how do you navigate that? Because we as a team struggle with it. So I can only imagine what it's like for you.
Yeah, it can be hard, but I think there's like a blend of, and I'm never going to get it perfect, but a blend of like honesty with positivity at the same time, even in moments that don't necessarily like feel positive. I mean, honestly, especially with everything that's going on right now, it's been really difficult. And I think it's important for people to see that even though I am optimistic, that I'm acknowledging the shared pain and confusion and fear about what the world is going to look like. And it's actually like impacting me as well. So I try to encourage people. I've been talking about self-sustainability a lot more now, just like, okay, there's a lot of doom and gloom. So if we want to continue to fight for this future and to have hope, we really need to nourish ourselves, our own bodies, our mental health, our communities, all those sorts of things. That's something that I think has been met with a lot of positivity, like having compassion even for activists, because I think a lot of activists are like, well, I always have to be on all the time. I care about this. I need to martyr myself for the cause. I'm like, no, please don't do that, because we need you in this movement. We need you to be healthy and taken care of, et cetera. So I try to talk about self-sustainability a lot and not really waver. And then I also try to just, again, like post a variety of different things. So not just overwhelming people with environmental hazards. Like, I will talk about those things, but then I also want to show people, okay, here are little things you can do in your day-to-day life, because that's usually the big question that I get. Like, if you are sharing some horrifying statistic with people, I think let them know what they can do. So even if it's like, this is the textile waste problem, having some sort of action item so people don't feel super overwhelmed. Because I think that's the most commonly asked question that I usually get, like, okay, this is horrifying. I feel horrible after this talk. Like, what can I do? So, like, coming prepared with at least a couple things or organizations I can direct them to. I think that's how I kind of like stay level-headed on social media.
Which is so great, you know, and I feel like, and I want to ask you a little bit about self-sustainability towards the end, but just quickly, because it's kind of what you said, just kind of popped up in my mind is, you know, another thing I feel like you speak about is progress over perfection. And I think the other thing that this digital age that we're living in has done has made it seem like we need to have all the solutions right away. We need to be doing them right now. Everything needs to change immediately. And, you know, there are so many nuances. Like, just going back to the EV car example, like, that is something that I struggle with all the time. You know, it's like transportation is our biggest, one of our biggest emitters. And electric cars are arguably so much better. But then, of course, it comes at the expense of lithium mining, which comes at the expense of like communities that, you know, already have gone through the ringer, and now it's like, oh wait, but also we need to mine all of that lithium, you know. But then equally, if somebody was like, you can have an EV or a fossil fuel car, I'd probably take the EV every time. But you know, it's like how we sort of also approach these things is like understanding that there are not any perfect solutions, there aren't any silver bullets, but how you sort of approach nuance, because I think that is something that often is lacking on social media, is like there is very little room for just like, you know, grayness or this takes time. It feels like there's just often very swift backlash of like yes, no, black, white, and how you sort of juggle that.
Yeah, I think what you said was great. Like, there's really no perfect solution for anything, and that we're all just navigating a society that's like built on capitalism and exploitation and doing the best that we can. And I think making the best decisions that we can. And then I think being authentic to who you are is also really important, and having a strong sense of self, because if you're on social media, like, people will pull and sway and tell you what you're doing is like good or bad or not good enough and all those sorts of things. And like, just being open to feedback, but also knowing like who you are and what your values are. And I think for me, especially as like a part-time content creator, it was really important for me to be like, this is who I am. So this is probably what I'm going to post about. This is what I care about. This might be my specific take. There are people who don't like that I talk about climate optimism, which I think is like kind of funny, but there are people who are like, you're just so happy all the time. Like, how can you be happy in this world? Like, you need to be like a realist. You need to be this. So there are people who might fight about whether you're a climate optimist or a climate doomist. But again, I'm like, I've decided that a part of my values are to be a climate activist, and I mean a climate optimist, and I'm okay with that. So I think, yeah, there's some like just having a strong sense of self and like what your values are, really taking some time to think about it. And then also being knowledgeable about those things, like, okay, like you said, lithium mining needs to be better for the environment and Indigenous communities. But right now, that is the best option that we have. So if you're able to make that choice, probably going with an electric car, but then also just staying up to date about, you know, how lithium mining can be better and maybe taking action if you can. So knowledge is power. I always say that. Try to be as knowledgeable as you can and then make the best decision that you can. And then when you know better, do better. If you didn't know better and you did something in the future, it's okay. Like, make those changes. And then just know that social media sometimes can be like, excuse my language, but like a hellhole. So like, just be really careful, know who you are. And
Yeah, I think being able to like put down the iPhone is very important, like, you know, at very certain times. And I think it's a nice time for me just to ask you a little bit about writing a book and, you know, your book, Intersectional Environmentalist. I feel like it must have been a breath of fresh air to maybe step away and go and write with your own thoughts and put your own words into the world. And like, I feel like there must have been something slightly cathartic about that. But I would love for you, just for, you know, anyone listening who might not know about the book or know exactly what's in it and would love to kind of understand the premise and maybe engage with it after listening. Like, can you tell us a little bit about kind of what went into that and how you settled on writing it?
Yeah. So The Intersectional Environmentalist is my first book, which is so wild, I guess, that it came out going on 2 years ago. And it's essentially just an introduction to what environmental justice is, what intersectionality is, how that stems from feminism, and also talks about ecofeminism, and really just makes an introductory connection for anyone who's like, what does identity and justice have to do with environmentalism? That's all I really wanted to do. I wanted to make it kind of like a fun introductory textbook. And it was the book that I wish I had when I started studying environmental science, because if I would have read that book in like my first year or when I started my activism journey, I think I would have just, a lot would have clicked, like why people and planet shouldn't be separated. So I wanted to do that for people in the most accessible way as possible and kind of remove shame from the equation. And that's The Intersectional Environmentalist. And yeah, I feel like there's just been, I feel so blessed. There's so many groups of people that have read it. And I don't know, from like middle schoolers to also like 80-year-old preachers, which is so cool. So it's really for anybody who's interested in starting their journey.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel like for anyone who's listening that wants to be an ally, you know, like, I think oftentimes as a white woman myself, I've felt like, you know, when it comes to racial justice or engaging in this, you know, it's like, where are my efforts best here? How can I be an ally? You know, how can I go about doing this in the right way? And I'm sure there are probably plenty of people listening to this who are in the same boat as me. So I don't know if you have any sort of advice for people in that position that you have found to be, you know, where people can be most helpful and, you know, like a strong ally without overstepping or saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing, which of course we all do at certain points, but, you know.
Yeah, I would say, like I said earlier, like knowledge is really power. And then even as a Black woman, there are so many communities outside of my own that I really just want to listen to and hear from and just like hear about their experiences and like being an ally to Indigenous communities in the US, like so many communities outside of my own. And I think the best thing that you can do is really just listen and learn, even if you don't fully understand someone else's experience, and just recognize the beauty of that. Like, okay, maybe the way I grew up in this world, like that's my experience. And get really curious about your own identity. Like, there's so many things that make us who we are, like where you grew up, the neighborhood you grew up in, your religious background, your family structure, all of those sorts of things. So get really curious about your own identity. And that's something that I also encourage for like white American or any white person who, because I don't know, especially in American culture and even sometimes in the UK or even in Canada, when it comes to like white Americans or white Canadians, like there is a culture. So it's really important for people also to get back to their roots outside of just like American whiteness or like Canadian whiteness. And I've seen that be a really beautiful exploratory journey for people who are like, oh, my family's Irish, and like, here are our traditions, and here's our folklore, and here's all these sorts of things. And just getting to know their own culture, because I feel like that can also help kind of empathize with other folks and also kind of break the idea that there's just like one American, like white culture, one like Canadian white culture, et cetera.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I remember I was very lucky that I had parents who were, I guess we would say hippies now, but, you know, they had alternative ways of thinking that they introduced me to really young. And I remember my mom giving me a book when I was, I don't know, like 13, called Touch the Earth. And it basically was about the experiences of Native Americans as, you know, white settlers moved onto their land. And just simply reading that book at an age where I was impressionable, I'm not kidding, probably changed the way I thought about so much. Like, and I remember giving it to my husband, who is like a white British guy. And literally he was like, now when we go to the beach, he's like, don't move the rocks. Horses have taken them to where they need to be, like, literally, you know. And it's funny because it doesn't actually take much to start questioning things. And I agree with you. It's like, I don't know when it became bad. Just like I don't know when the environmental movement became politicized, I don't know when it became a bad thing to question origins, other ways of lives, other, you know, it's like, you know, those are not bad things. Those are all part of the human experience. So thank you for that answer, because I feel like that's exactly right. And probably really helpful for many to hear. And I think just to kind of finish this off, Leah, I would love, you know, you talked about sort of self-sustainability. I know you've also spoken about eco-anxiety. I think there are, as I just mentioned, I mean, it's just even the start of, you know, 2023, it was like, boom, just, you know, hottest, or 2024, sorry, 2023 was the hottest year on record. You know, we, I'm here on the coast of Maine. We had the strongest storm I have ever seen here the other day, like, you know, flooding, trees, you know, you can see it now. It is happening. Climate change is here. It will probably get a lot worse before it gets better. I think we have to acknowledge that. And, you know, so eco-anxiety is something I definitely struggle with, but I'm always trying to think of, like, you know, I always think like action is the antidote to despair, but for some people that's harder to grasp. So in terms of how you deal with it and you keep motivated, like, do you have any sort of tips or practices that you have that you would suggest as being really powerful?
I think right now, and maybe it's because it's January, but I really want to keep it up. Yeah, I'm just like getting back into play, I guess, as an adult. So, and I feel like this helps me stay motivated and take action. So I'm like taking pottery classes and like adult painting classes and things like that. And then somehow it's like making me more grateful for the earth, because even when I'm like painting, I think about all of the colors that are found in nature. Or when I'm like, I don't know, like doing ceramics and throwing on the wheel, I think about how beautiful it is that clay is just something that exists in our ecosystem and like makes me appreciate the earth even more. So I think I'm finding like the more I actually take care of myself, the more I can show up authentically in like the communities that I want to show up in, the more I can show up empathetically, because I'm actually like taking the time to care for myself. So I just want people to know that it's not optional. And that's something that even like a lot of revolutionaries would talk about, like Angela Davis. You can find her talking about self-care, even like radical civil rights activists from the 60s. They knew the importance of like self-care and community care and all those sorts of things. So I want people to know that taking time for yourself is just so essential, and to really tap into like those moments of like adult, I don't know what to call it, just like, you know, nurturing your inner child as an adult.
I love that you said play. I feel like, and it's honestly because it is something that I think our culture also has really taught us not to do, you know, like there's no time to paint. There's no time to like do any of that. Like you have to be like constantly working. And I feel like those are actually the moments, like I always find it so funny when I actually stop and like do a yoga class or walk my dog or even have a glass of wine and make dinner. Those are often the times I actually have ideas or draw moments of real strength for myself. Like it's not normally when I'm just sat at my laptop for 8 hours on end just like trying to, you know, produce. Like we need those sort of things. So I love that you said like play and how that's important to you. And I guess, you know, to finish things off, I would just love to hear what you're feeling the most hopeful about for 2024. You know, like and one thing I actually didn't ask you about was like this idea of ecofeminism. I find that it's such a worthy and it's such a real concept, you know, like whenever I'm in this space, of course there are men doing incredible things. Do not get me wrong, but there is a lot of feminine energy here too. So actually, I guess that's two final questions. One is, you know, how are you feeling about ecofeminism and how are you feeling about hope in the new year?
Ecofeminism, really excited to explore. I feel like it's been a journey of me being like, I'm an intersectional environmentalist, to then realizing like, yeah, I'm an ecofeminist that also like cares about social justice and like other things. So yeah, it's been really nice coming back to ecofeminism and just, yeah, that's a new project that I'll be working on. So hopefully my next book will be about that subject. And then I don't know, 2024, I think just preparing myself emotionally for an election year and knowing that's going to require, I think the thing that's really going to help is getting really plugged into my community, like my local community. So I would encourage people to do that. So whether it's about, you know, community action and things that need to change, but also pairing that with like volunteer days, like art classes, sorry, whatever it might be. So I think that's what I'm looking forward to in 2024. And I hope people also get really involved with their local community.
You know, and actually, Leah, I do want to take this opportunity because one of the other podcasts I just recorded was with Reverend Yearwood, and we talked a lot about this. So I would love to actually get your take on this as it is an election year. It's an important election year. You know, I think there's a real fear that people are going to sit this one out because we don't have a lot of candidates that maybe speak to everything people would want. But I do think there's a danger in that because there's, you know, if you are an environmental voter, you know, there's a very clear choice here between just invite like voting for a candidate who might not have done everything you wanted, but, you know, is actually talking about it versus like sitting it out. I know that there are people considering policies with war that they don't approve of, or, you know, very real concerns. All of these are so real, but how are you approaching this? Because it is arguably one of the most important elections that we'll have in a very long time. And the earth is in a really critical moment. And, you know, how are you sort of thinking about this with your community, with how you are wanting to speak about it, with how you're thinking about it? I think anyone here in America who's listening to this is probably going through a lot of these questions themselves. So I would just love to get your take on it before we sign off.
Yeah, I would say I have a lot of empathy for people who are feeling that way. I think, yeah, the two-party system, it's not my favorite. I don't think it represents a lot of Americans. And there's a lot going on right now that I think kind of differs from my personal values. So I think one thing is understanding again, like that the federal government is just like one piece of the pie. And I think getting involved, like still engaging and voting, but also really getting involved with like local elections, because I think that's something that we almost like as a society need like re-education on. Even just living in California, it's so cool. A lot of the things that we have are laws that have been passed in California because of people organizing here. So I think I want to encourage people to like still engage, but also know when you're voting like locally and like you can actually see some pretty significant transformations that are happening. And so I think that's something that I want to push people to. And then I also want to put some responsibility on our leaders to listen to the people. And I think that's why there's a lot of disruption. So I'm really hoping there's like student loan forgiveness or like really big policy changes that will really encourage Gen Z especially to vote. I think that's something I'm really concerned about. I am concerned that Gen Zers are not going to show up because I don't think there's been enough policy change that's like directly impacted them. So that's another tangent for another day. So I do hope this year our leaders kind of have some policy changes that are maybe a little bit more obvious or like historic. So people who might not normally engage with elections can say like, oh my goodness, student loans were forgiven or like whatever it might be to kind of incentivize more people to vote.
And do you think for Gen Zers, if anyone's listening to this and you know, really finding a lot of truth in what you say, but would you still say like it's important to make steps to vote just because, you know, it's like, it's also a huge, it's a huge privilege for us to be able to vote, you know, and to not exercise that power one way or the other. It does seem like, you know, we need to, it also seems like sort of a shame to not use that power if you have it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say it's such a privilege to be able to vote. And then also at the same time, I think the way we vote is very outdated and could be made a lot easier. Like even if we had like voting places at high schools, colleges, if there is a way to do it on your phone, I don't know, like all those sorts of things.
I know, so I'm like, we need like a really secure government app that like just has people like
we would see votes go up so much. So I think at the same time, I really want to put some pressure on our leaders to make it easier for people. And then I do want to encourage Gen Zers to still get out and vote because, yeah, it's a really important right that we have.
It is. Well, thank you, Leah. I will stop bombarding you with all these really big questions. And thank you so much for taking the time. And very excited to see what you bring out in 2024. And yeah, just again, thank you for all the work that you've done.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.